I call the meeting of the House of Higher Education Finance and Policy Division to order. We do have a quorum. We have a motion to approve the minutes for March 13th, 2019.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Vang. She moves the minutes. All those, is there any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 13th, 2019 are approved. We have Vice Chair Pryor has a bill up today, and I'm just wondering, does anybody mind if I go to our next do you have testifiers that are going to be testifying?
I don't think they're still right now.
Okay, so it'd be perfect, the plan that I have here. We're going to start with Representative Mueller's bill, an education debt grant relief funding bill. If that's okay, we'll put you at the top of the agenda.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 2363 be laid over.
Okay. For possible inclusion. So Representative Pryor moves House File 2363 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Well, welcome to our committee, Representative Mueller. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And I apologize. I realize this is my first time in front of this committee, and I do have Girl Scout cookies in my office. I did not bring them with me, but you are welcome to come to the fifth floor after committee. I will be there, and I will be happy to share Girl Scout cookies with you.
Well, that's okay, and because I don't really like that policy because I think it's a form of hazing. So anyway, so in our higher education committee, we welcome you not bringing them.
All right. Okay,
Madam Chair, I will be visiting her office.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
So, Madam Chair, if I may, and members, this is the Loan Repayment Assistance Program, also known as LRAP, and this program helps to reduce the education debt burden experienced by dedicated public interest lawyers who represent low-income clients seeking legal services to secure essential needs like food, shelter, and safety, and fundamental rights like equal access to justice. And this bill seeks continued grant funding to LRAP to reduce the education debt burden experienced by dedicated legal aid lawyers. Law school debt is, you know, easily $150,000 or more, and legal aid salaries are some of the lowest salaries in the state, starting at $50,000 or less. And I serve in the Judiciary Committee, and we've been hearing about the great underfunding of our legal aid attorneys, but also the high need for those services and the number of clients they have to turn away. So loan repayment assistance helps Minnesota legal aid attorneys meet their own basic needs like housing, transportation, and child care while paying off significant education debt. And in turn, those attorneys are able to help thousands of low-income clients in our state. So that's all I'm going to say about the bill. And if I can, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you very much. And welcome to our committee. If you could state your name and who you're with for the record, that would be wonderful.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heather Vlieger, and I'm the Executive Director of LRAP Minnesota. As Representative Mueller said, we're a nonprofit organization with a mission to reduce the education debt burden of dedicated public interest attorneys so they can serve low-income clients throughout our state. They help low-income clients secure food, shelter, safe and suitable housing, and freedom from domestic violence. As we mentioned, their education debt is staggering and legal aid salaries are relatively low. We receive funding from a broad range of sources, from the individuals, law firms, the Minnesota law schools, but the state of Minnesota funding we received last biennium made a huge difference. For example, in 2018, we were able to add 5 attorneys to our program. That brought the total in our state to 50 who were receiving loan repayment assistance. And in turn, each of those attorneys served about 200 low-income clients. Many of those attorneys live and work in greater Minnesota, about 40% of them, so we're truly reaching the entire state of Minnesota. There is need to do more when it comes to loan repayment assistance. We need to fund more legal aid attorneys. As Representative Mueller mentioned, there's great unmet need for legal aid. We're also hoping to increase the percentage of income-driven repayment amounts that we're able to cover. Our program leverages the Federal Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. We make it possible for our attorneys to make 10 years of income-driven qualifying payments, and then the rest of their federal education loans are forgiven. And that truly enables them to commit to their careers in legal aid. I think it's best to hear from an LRAP attorney who is doing the important work in the community. So I'd love to introduce Lars Markison, who's been in our program for several years now.
We have a question before we move on to our next testifier. Vice Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we've heard about the difficulty sometimes of working with the owners of the student loans and to actually qualify for those, and that different bill, different situation. What's the do you have success of actually having earning these loan forgiveness programs from these federal programs?
Representative Pryor, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are excited to share that we had our first LRAP recipient receive public service loan forgiveness in July of 2018. Part of what we do is we work with each recipient to help them make sure that they're qualifying for the program. The CCRAA that rolled out public service loan forgiveness, it did not introduce its own income-driven repayment plan until 2019, so we're very early when it comes to forgiveness, and I'm working with a national group that's trying to analyze when folks thought they were eligible for public service loan forgiveness and they applied, what was going on? Were they truly eligible? We're making sure that our recipients are making the right kind of payments, income-driven repayment, on the right kind of loans. They have to be direct loans, and then we're making sure that the employment definitely qualifies. Our folks work in 501c3 nonprofit organizations. You're right to be concerned, but we're very hopeful with the careful work that we've done to make sure that our recipients are eligible, that we've set them up for the best possible success in that arena.
I was going to wait until after we heard from the testifier, if that's all right.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, thank you.
You may proceed, Mr. Markison.
Markison, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here. My name is Lars Markison. I'm an attorney with Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. I did spend my first 4 years with legal aid working in our Wilmer office, covering 10 counties from Big Stone over to Meeker and down to Lincoln and Lyon. And now for the last 3.5 years, I've been working in our Minneapolis office. As was sort of discussed before, right now, legal aid simply is not able to pay enough for me to cover my student loan payments. Before you finish law school, they say, well, you should find a job that pays an annual salary equal to the amount of your debt. Right now, even after working 8 years at legal aid, 3.5 years as a judicial law clerk before that, I'm still not even earning half of what I would need for that. Not even able to make my monthly interest payments right now, and so that amount keeps going up as well. So likely without LRAP, I would need to be finding a second job in order to cover my regular expenses. And so LRAP removes that worry for me, gives me more time and energy to focus on assisting my clients. And that's been a great help for me here. Recently, I sort of, as an example of the work I've done, I've represented a young man who had applied for disability benefits from Social Security through the SSI program. Looking at the surface level, you would think that he wouldn't qualify. He was an intelligent young man, had a B average in high school, participated in martial arts, played musical instruments, but I was able to help work with him, work with his family, dig into his records a bit to find that while he was very intelligent, he simply did not have the social skills necessary for it to be able to maintain regular employment. He wasn't able to respond to frustration without attacking people, without shutting down. When getting frustrated, he at times had attempted to jump out of moving cars. And so because I was able to help him and help his family navigate the whole Social Security system, we were able to get him onto those SSI benefits, which now allows him to live independently and is able to focus on developing those social skills necessary. And so he could put that focus there so that he'll be successful when he starts working, rather than having to worry now about the added financial stress of trying to figure out how he's going to pay for his regular bills. More than once in my time here in Legal Aid, I've been asked to speak with potentially new hires about the LRAC program and how it can help them financially. And as unfortunately, as Ms. Vlieger stated, that not everyone is able to receive LRAC that applies and would otherwise qualify. Additionally, we've already had some attorneys who have worked at Legal Aid, but even then only last for a year or two, because even with LRAP's help, they're simply not able to financially cover their necessary bills, which means that the new attorneys that we have coming in are just barely getting enough experience, and then they're moving on to somewhere else that can afford that. So, again, I'd ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd also like to thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this bill forward. I have had an opportunity to work with many lawyers who serve in Legal Aid, and I'd like to say thank you for your service for that. It's a difficult job, and sometimes you have really difficult clients. But what I would like to know is if you could expand a little bit more to help the committee truly understand the need for attorneys to work for legal aid, and to maybe talk about how many attorneys you have compared to what the need might be for legal aid services, and just so we can kind of get an understanding of why it's important for us to do these grants so that we have the positions filled that are needed.
Sure. Okay.
Mr. Markison.
Sure. So I guess I don't actually know the number of attorneys that we have, but what I do know is that for every three people that come in our door who would qualify for our services, we're turning away two of those three people because we're simply not able to represent them. A lot of times we have clients, too, that could use our full representation. We just don't have the resources, and best we can do is give them advice and tell them good luck. You know, and this was even more so out in when I was working in our Wilmer area, where I literally had clients saying, "Where else can I go?" Mm-hmm. And all I could say was, "There is nowhere else. I'm sorry." And so it's definitely a need that's needed, that legal aid for having more attorneys who can help represent those people. Which also that them having representation helps to speed up processes, whether that be administrative processes with Social Security and with Department of Human Services, or that's in our court system. Having that representation really speeds up the process because there's an attorney to explain that to them rather than them taking up that extra time of the courts needing to explain to them what's going on.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative, I was just going to say,
Madam Chair, I would just urge us to really consider this. It's not a large sum of money, but it's a really critical piece of funding. Thank you.
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the testifiers for your work that you do. I work at Homeline, and Legal Aid is a good partnership with Homeline. I'm more curious about the grant process. I want to know how do you apply for the grant, and is there like a maximum amount that you can ask for?
Ms. Vlieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Gang. We have a competitive process. We accept applications twice per year. The requirements for application would be that you be working full-time in a 501c3 nonprofit organization, providing representation to low-income clients or support for representation to low-income clients. An example of support might be an attorney who works for the Volunteer Lawyers Network, for example, so they're supporting the attorneys that have a private practice but who also volunteer to represent low-income clients. We are a needs-based program, so we assess the income of the applicants as well as consider assets, but also want to make sure that folks are able to achieve financial aims like owning a home. So we have allowance for assets, but make sure that we're looking at need. And then we have a process of anonymity where everyone goes into a spreadsheet and we look just at their numbers, basically the kind of the data. We rank our applicants by years of experience because experienced attorneys can help more clients with more complex matters and can often resolve things because of the community connections they have with just a quick letter. So once all of that is done, we look at the funding we have available and then again offer it in order of years of experience. We seek to cover a percentage of income-driven repayment amounts. So it's going to vary by individual, but it's IDR based on their salary as a legal aid attorney so that we're looking at everyone on equal footing. And then the percentage of IDR amount covered will vary by years of experience. Right now the range is 70 to 85%. Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think it was a week or two ago the Attorney General was presenting on their budget, and one of the slides had average first-year attorney in Twin Cities private sector at $139,239. I'm just curious for the legal aid positions what sort of range is for the average, you know, first year, and then an idea as to the debt load, because that was coming, that might help us judge the differences between, you know, the private sector and here.
Ms. Leaguer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The average education debt for Minnesota legal aid attorneys is about $150,000 per year, and legal aid starting salary is about $50,000 per year.
Okay, thank you. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just thank you, Representative Muller, for bringing forward this bill. I think it's really important. And thank you to Mr. Markeson. I appreciate that you have remained in public service. One thing that I think we all benefit when people go to college and get that experience and then enter into public the public realm and continue along those lines, because we all benefit, we all can see the need and understand it. So I appreciate that you, even having this insurmountable debt ahead of you, that you continue to do that. So I appreciate that, and I just wanted to commend you for that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other members? Representative Zhang.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mueller, for bringing this legislation in for the two attorneys that are committing to public service. My second year of law school, I interned at Legal Aid Office in Minneapolis, and I got my student attorney, they had a sign off so I can go in court, and so I got it with Genevieve Gaborio, and I don't know if she's still there, but just want to thank you for all the great work you do. I know the caseload, the work, the emotions that you have to deal with is tremendous. I hope that we can help them out. And you guys got lucky. I'm here, not there, causing trouble for you. But thank you for your work. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, members. Would you like to say any closing remarks? Is there another question? No. Okay, would you like to say some closing remarks, Representative Mueller?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just wanted to thank you today for your questions and for the opportunity to present this bill to you, and I hope that House File 2363 will end up in your omnibus bill and that you will end up supporting it. So thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you to our testifiers.
Thank you.
Oh, I didn't ask anybody else. Hold on. Is anyone else in the public here would like to testify on this bill? You are welcome to. We can back up. We don't have to always go forward. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I do need to renew. Go ahead.
I would like to renew my motion, Madam Chair.
Okay. And Vice Chair Pryor renews your motion to move that House File 2363 be laid over for possible inclusion. Okay. Now, Vice Chair Pryor. Hello and welcome to your committee, Vice Chair Pryor.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Bernardi.
Would you like to start by moving your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 993 for possible inclusion, to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay, thank you. Proceed.
Well, thank you, Chair Bernardi and members. So 2 years ago, one of the first committees that I was on as a freshman legislator was the higher ed, where we are right now. And I heard some great bills at that time, and one of them was the one that's before you right now, which is to have a workforce development scholarships. And so what we're looking at is, we know in the state of Minnesota we have certain gaps in employment needs, workforce needs in Minnesota, and we also know that we have young people that are seeking an education and will always be struggling to afford it. And so this is a way to put those two things together. You know, here's our workforce needs. Here's some young people that are interested in those careers, but they need the extra money. They need the scholarships to be able to pursue those degrees. And then there's also another element to the success of this is that we have employers that need these people in the workforce too, and sometimes you can leverage extra dollars, private dollars, to go with this too. So I would like to, before you, House File 993 is a way of pulling this together, but it's not an original idea. It's been introduced before, and we've had some sex with it before, and I would like to turn it over to my testifiers to tell you more.
Thank you, and welcome to our committee, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, and thank you, members, and thank you, Representative Pryor, for allowing me to share the podium with you today just to testify on this bill. I had the privilege last year with Representative Norris of carrying this legislation, and I got very involved in the actual implementation of it, so just wanted to share some of those thoughts with you. This is really a success story of public-private partnership. We saw the need. The manufacturers, the industry were coming to us, telling us we need these skill sets in IT, in advanced manufacturing, in advanced agriculture, for example. And the students, of course, saying, you know, want to go to school, want to get these skills, but can't afford the cost of college. So that's how this really came to fruition. I want you to know that the Minnesota state system just executed on this beautifully. It was well publicized. You could go to any, you know, school with information. It was on their website, many meetings with manufacturers and students and families. The foundations at these schools also then raised money. So the original goal of the legislation last biennium was 400 students for $2,500 each. They did give 397 student scholarships, and many of those students got more than $2,500 because of the private industry match, and the testifier will tell you more about that. So again, I just want to tell you, I think it's sometimes we don't know when we pass legislation, did it work? Did it have an impact? This worked. It worked beyond what we even expected, and it's helping many, many students, and it's helping build our future skilled workforce. So proud to be here today to share with Representative Pryor to help hopefully get this included in your omnibus bill. And I'll turn it over to Myron Moser, who's the CEO of Hartfield Automation and has been very involved with our higher education system as well, and he'll tell you about his experience.
Hello and welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name and who you're with again, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. I'm Myron Moser. I'm CEO and Chairman of Hartfield Automation. And so thank you and Vice Chair Pryor and members for letting me talk a little bit about workforce development. Just to start out with, we're a great benefactor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. At last count, I have 63 of my 253 employees that have Minnesota college degrees, and we're spread across 20 states. So that's a pretty good average. that's my first job. Hartfield is an automation, motion control, and robotics company. My second job is I'm president of the Hennepin Tech College Foundation Board. We raise funds for scholarships and grants for needy students. I've been on that board for 13 years, and to date, since inception, we've raised over $11 million in cash and gifts in kind. So there's a lot of enthusiasm with businesses like mine to get in touch with the colleges today. So I've invested a lot of time and money in technical education. I myself am a graduate of Granite Falls, Minnesota West, which is a technical college. And in my 29 years at Hartfield Automation, I have purchased 5 companies and started 4 more. All have been successful. So I'm a pretty good testimony to technical education. Hartfield is a Minnesota success story. So for 60 of our 61 years, we've been headquartered in Representative Pryor's backyard of Eden Prairie and appreciated that. And since I've come to Hartfield, we were a little over $4 million, and we're going to be about $185 million this year. So it's a 40x growth factor. It's been a phenomenal time. So I'd like to talk a little bit about a problem that I think we can all solve together. And we aren't waiting. We're actually doing something about it and have been for years. And that is the whole idea of the workforce gap that we're seeing. Our Minnesota economy is very diverse. We've had slow but steady growth. If you ask most business people, they'll tell you, I prefer this over that, right? But I think a threat to our continued growth is a lack of workers. You can have a great business with great growth potential, but without great employees, your production, your output, your results are stalled, and as a result, so is the tax revenue, which isn't great for the state. So we have a growing workforce gap. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the Metropolitan Council study that was printed in the Pioneer Press in 2016. It said for every one person reaching working age, there'll be 21 reaching retirement age by the year 2020, and that trend will accelerate through the year 2030. So the early thought was, well, the baby boomers, guys like me, are going to have to work longer. And that's turned out to be a myth so far. We tend to be retiring at 65 like previous generations. So the big opportunity we have is to shrink the workforce gap. And I think where we do that is with the underprivileged. When you talk about the underprivileged, you're talking about people that are working many times more than one job. In fact, we have students that are working 2 and 3 jobs and still going to school. Well, the ones that are living hand-to-mouth don't have the luxury of pressing pause and going to college for 2 years, say nothing of 4. And as a result, they keep doing what they're doing. I don't have visibility of those people unless and until they're engaged in a college program. I mean, my only other choice is to drive around and knock on doors. That's kind of a slow and lonely progress invitation. So the point is, until and unless we can get them into college, we don't know where they are. Once they're in college, we can and do. We offer internships at Hartfield, and we can and do support them and pay for their tuition. We offer up to 4 years of $5,000 a year tuition. And we'll do that for selected interns, and we do that for employees that we have, with the idea of trying to get them to grow to better jobs. That's good for them. That's good for us. So I think the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry pipeline program is a great beginning step. And I was part of that as we worked on that together. In fact, Hartfield has done their own version of that for many years. We didn't just start doing that 2 years ago. So the underprivileged hold a key to it. Minnesota population at last count was 5.611 million, and about 11% of those are at the poverty line or below, and that means you're talking about a little better than 610,000 people. If we could just find a way to get 10% of them educated and into the workforce, that's 61,000 people. I think we're at very close to full employment as a state. I can tell you that from a business standpoint, my observation is the war for talent is just getting started, and it's going to get a lot uglier. I think the potential to slow down our state growth is at stake as well, unless we figure out how to do that. So I bring you to the importance of workforce scholarships. Workforce scholarships help students to reduce the amount of outside need that they have for income. So it's not a handout. You have students that are working three jobs that now only have to work two plus go to college, or working two jobs that can now drop one and spend more time studying and get through college faster. So Hennepin Tech last year, workforce scholarships make filling the high-demand positions possible. We're talking about the manufacturing, agricultural, IT that the DLI pipeline program addresses, and now early childhood, hopefully. So last year, Hennepin Tech received funding for 16 workforce scholarships. We raised an extra $54,000 and awarded 21. This year, we received funding for 8. We raised an extra amount of money and are awarding 16. So we think that's a really good place to put investment. Because these are kids, and I can tell you that in just the general scheme of things, as we raise funds for scholarships, the eligible applicants for scholarships, we turn about 2 out of 3 away because we don't have enough funds. So we're going back to businesses. We're trying to raise even more cash to fund that on our own as best we can. The need is there. The enthusiasm is there. One of the additional barriers, and I've testified to the Senate about this as well, to technical education that we're trying to work on right now is to get the word out to high school students. The average age of a Hennepin Tech College graduate is 27 years old. At the height of the recession, it was 31. What does that tell us? That tells us that the average student at Hennepin Tech doesn't come from high school. They might have taken the path that is pushed by a lot of schools and well-meaning people, and that is 4-year college for everybody, 4-year university for everybody. Well, that doesn't fit everybody. And so you get people, and we see the problem in our country today, that go off to college, kids do, they graduate with a mountain of debt and no idea what to do. And so they accept what's called gray-collar jobs. They're underemployed, but they got to do something to start paying down the debt meter. High school students, the interest is there. I can tell you, I go talk to high schools. Wayzata High School is the biggest high school in the state. They have a program called Compass. They turned away about 2 out of 3 again this past year. Compass program takes high school students and exposes them to college courses, including technical college courses. And then they bring speakers and mentors in, like myself, to work with the kids to help them figure out what they want to do and set an educational path in that direction. There's great appetite at high schools like Wayzata. There are other high schools that tend to brag quite a bit about their 4-year college and university enrollees. Mind you, they don't tell you what percentage of them finish 4-year college and what percentage of them are employed in anything that even remotely resembles what they went to college for, because that rate's a lot lower. But when you look at Hennepin Tech, they have a 98.5% rate of hire in the field of study. The kids that come out of that college are working, they're producing, they're paying taxes, they're generating strength in our economy every year. It's a great way to go. So I'm trying to get the word out to high schools, but I have only so much time. So it's there's me and a handful of us that are kind of the voices crying in the wilderness somewhat. There's also a stigma attached to technical college. And I'll tell you what I'm going to do about that, or what we are doing about that now. But I can tell you, back when I went to technical college 39 years ago, it was the same back then. The thought was, if you weren't smart enough to hack a 4-year college, if you were kind of in the dummies and the misfits, you went to technical college. Nothing is further from the truth. I knew what I wanted to do when I was a junior in high school. I simply took the fastest route to it. So I didn't feel the need for examining butterflies and things like that. I knew what I wanted to do, and I went at it. Nothing against 4-year degrees, by the way. I have a lot of employees that work for me that have 4-year degrees and advanced degrees. Nothing against them. They're good people. So we're convening a work group of industry, high school superintendents, and college officials this spring to experiment together. And the question is, what can we do to fill the workforce gap? Because that's good for all of us, businesses, colleges, students, and the state. If any legislators are interested in joining us, we're going to do this after the school session ends, probably at end of May, early June. I already have the superintendent of Robbinsdale. I've got several others that are involved that will come together at our place. We're going to have a day-long brainstorming session. Pick a couple of things and try it. So in closing, I think the environment has never been more ripe to solve these lingering challenges. The business community is starting to really get it. There's a disconnect that can be solved, I think, at the high schools. Parents are becoming more aware of the problems of kids going to four-year colleges and universities when they could go to technical college, and that probably fits them better, and racking up all that debt and still not being satisfied. Statistics are that the economy will need the following ratio of people for the next 30-plus years. This comes from Kevin Fleming's Excellent Success in the New Economy. If you haven't seen that, I'm happy to offer that through Vice Chair Pryor for you to look at. It's a 9-minute video. I will apologize in advance for some of the animation. It looks a little hokey, but it's well-researched. It's a great piece, and it talks about where the jobs will be in the next 30 years, over the next 30 years. And he offers the ratio of 1 to 2 to 7 for every one job that requires a graduate or postgraduate degree. There'll be two jobs in the economy that require a four-year degree, an undergrad, and there'll be seven jobs that require technicians, certifications, technical college, associate degrees, things like that. That's where a lot of the fighting is really going to happen in the war for talent. I'm sure those of you that have taken your car in to have it fixed, there was a time where you would call up and the response was, how quick can you get here? The response now is, how about next Tuesday? We're having to wait longer for services as a result of those jobs not being as filled. So we in business are reaching out. We're trying to do things, and I would ask for your help, our legislative leaders, and I think together we can make the state a model for the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I'm sorry again. What was your name, sir?
Myron Moser.
Moser.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Moser, you briefly mentioned the pipeline program through the Department of Labor and Industry, and I don't know if either the bill's author or co-author want to weigh in, or maybe nonpartisan staff, but is that program still up and running? I think it was first funded in 2015. Does it have ongoing base appropriations? Is this duplicating programming? Is it go hand in hand?
I can answer a little bit, Madam Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
And Representative Lean, I serve on the Jobs Committee this session, and so the DEED budget is something that will be put together out of the Jobs Committee. That's where Pipeline is funded, not Department of Labor and Industry, I'm correct? So that is currently a proposal to continue a funding pipeline, but it comes out of the DEED budget. So this does not duplicate the pipeline program, though, these workforce development scholarships.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the main difference between the two? Because I know pipeline also focuses on manufacturing, ag, healthcare, IT. Here we're adding early childhood to this bill, but it's not in the existing program. How did the two work together, or what is the difference between the two?
Thank you, Representative Lean. Sorry, thank you. The pipeline program, as I understand it and have been part of it, is meant to help encourage employers to offer education to their employees and or hire interns and sponsor them through college. So we had developed our own program that the pipeline kind of mimics in certain ways, I guess. So if you're an employer and you want to send one of your employees back for a degree that would help them in advanced manufacturing, for instance, the pipeline program would help reimburse up to a certain level, I think it's $6,000, of scholarship or tuition, I should say, for that employee to complete that. So you would pay for it, and the pipeline program would reimburse you, the employer, for the funds that you spent on tuition.
Vice Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Lean. I do appreciate the question because I know that these are the kind of things that we need to work out in our committee. And I do wonder if Nonpartisan also has comment to make on this too as clarification.
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, so the workforce development scholarships under this bill are separate from the pipeline program, although they do have similar goals in terms of workforce development. On the higher ed side of the pipeline program, the Office of Higher Education administers what are called dual training competency grants, and these are the grants that Mr. Moser was talking about to employers to help reimburse them when they partner with the higher education institution to train employees. So the dual training competency grants are separate from the workforce development grant, workforce development scholarships that are addressed in this bill.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just one more, hopefully just one more question. For Representative Haley, because you're on that committee or Nonpartisan staff, what's the appropriation request for the pipeline program, or where, how much has it been funded in the past? Or maybe we can look into it and connect offline.
Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and committee members, yes, the pipeline program for both OHE and the Department of Labor and Industry through the higher ed bill does have an existing base appropriation. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I can report back to the committee with those.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question might be for Representative Haley, I'm not sure. You kind of introduced the bill by talking about the history and the success and how this scholarship program has been widely promoted. This is a really big deal in northeastern Minnesota, and our K through 12, our high schools now are moving to models where they allow students to go on tracks, almost like the old European model. You went to ninth grade and you pick a track. And on the core iron range, they're going to all in on an academy model where everybody picks a track. So we're trying to gear students really for these technical degrees that'll get them a job right away. And therefore, we have community foundations and things that are giving scholarships. There's scholarships everywhere. So what I'm wondering is this the only scholarship program from the state to two-year colleges for these kinds of degrees? That's my first question. And then number two, with your experience with the program so far, how many schools were involved, how many students were involved, and what is the eligibility? I mean, it doesn't say that it's income eligible. So what is the eligibility?
Representative Lehman, if you don't mind, we have a staff person who would like to share some information. Is that okay, Representative Haley? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, just to correct what I said to Representative Lehman, I do have the answer for the appropriation side of the question. In current laws of the last higher education omnibus bill, the Department of Labor and Industry through OHE receives a $200,000 a year grant for the specific purpose. And then off the higher education also receives $2 million per year for the dual training competency grants. So the base for the OHE competency grants is $2 million, and the base for the DOLI training grants is $200,000.
Okay. Does that help, Representative Lehman?
So it was $2 million?
Mr. Savory.
Members, the appropriation is broken into two distinct pieces. Piece number one goes to the Department of Labor and Industry,
okay,
and that's $200,000 per year, so $400,000 for the biennium.
Okay.
And then the second piece are competency grants that go to the Office of Higher Education, and that's the $2 million piece per year, so $4 million for the biennium.
Okay, Madam Chair, so that's $2 million for the program that we're talking about here.
No, so House File 993 speaks directly to the operations, the O&M appropriation for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And so that this bill, as it's written now, would adjust a rider within the O&M appropriation for Minnesota State. Because there are blanks within this appropriation, we don't really know at this point what the intention is there. But it will adjust that rider one way or the other for this particular bill.
Okay. So then, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers, whoever can answer, but the other part of my question, because I'm really interested in this and accessing this, is how many schools were involved and what is the eligibility to get a scholarship?
Representative Haley.
Madam Chair and Representative Lehman. And I could forward this to the committee, the short report from Minnesota State. It's only about 6 pages long, so it's not a long read. But I can give you that information based on this report. I have the entire list of all the Minnesota State technical colleges that participated. Again, 397 students received scholarships for a total of $500,000 was awarded. And the requirements is that they need to complete a program of study. They are participating in a certain number of credits. It is, as you said, you know, income-based, so they would be filling out a FAFSA form like they do for other tuition awards or scholarships. They have to be entering, again, one of these high-demand fields. Mm-hmm. They have to have maintain a 2.0 GPA, a minimum of 9 credits per term, and the preferences for students with financial need, and the preferences also for students that may be what we call non-traditional students. We're looking for a diversity of students in all fields, maybe recruiting more females in manufacturing, for an example, or males in healthcare. So and to Mr. Moser's point, really targeted to get students who maybe weren't considering any type of post-secondary education and to attract them to where their aptitude and their interest is and help get them on their way. I hope that helps, yeah, Representative Lane.
That does answer my questions. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. And Mr. Savory would like to add something.
And Madam Chair and committee members, just to clarify, that rider within the O&M appropriation for Minnesota State, the base for that per year is $1 million. So this House File 993 would be adjusting that $1 million.
And I actually do have a question. It doesn't necessarily have to do with your bill, but, well, sort of, but not something you're proposing. Did I hear men in healthcare? Is that one of the targeted groups? Did I hear that correctly? Ms. Haley?
Madam Chair, I was just using that as an example. Healthcare is a targeted industry sector that these scholarships are focused on. And when I was speaking to maybe getting a non-traditional student and getting more diversity in all these fields, it was just an example.
Okay. Would you like to make, and before we make closing comments, I just want to thank Mr. Moser for his partnerships with students and schools and business. It's something that's very needed in our state, and we thank you for being a leader in that.
Sometimes I listen.
Representative Pryor, would you like to make closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I also want to echo my gratitude for Mr. Moser for being here and for the pep talk you gave today about technical education. We appreciate that perspective. And also to thank my colleague and fellow freshman, Representative Haley. It's good to see you in the Higher Ed Committee again. Good memories of the committee from past. And so, members, I definitely think this is something that we should put in the mix and think about of a way of bringing what we know is important in Minnesota to what is important to students, and you know, see if this is a way to match up those needs. Thank you for considering it for inclusion.
Thank you. And with that, do you renew your motion?
And with that, I renew my motion.
Okay. So Vice Chair Pryor renews her motion that House File 993 be laid over for possible inclusion. Okay. So with that, we get to end early today. And thank you, committee. That was excellent. I appreciate that. And we will see you tomorrow. No, tomorrow.